This is the Elizabeth School District Board of Directors meeting, business session, December 13th, 2021. And I call this meeting to order. The time is 6 o'clock. All right, can I get a roll call, please?
Director Blackham?
Here.
Director Booth?
Here.
Director Frumkeller?
Here.
Director Karcher?
Here.
Director Olson?
Here.
All right, would you all stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, we will not have a showcase, an education showcase today. So I'm going to move directly to looking for a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Blackham?
Aye.
Director Booth?
Aye.
Director Frumkeller?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Yes.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right. I'd like a motion to approve the minutes from the Board of Education meeting November 15th, 2021.
So I don't think Craig or Heather can vote. Because this is from when...
Correct.
Carol, Paul were still on. Okay. So just Rhonda, Kim, and...
Yep.
All right.
So moved.
Okay. Roll call, please.
Do I still read their names?
Ours.
Just like yours. Director Frumkeller?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Yes.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes from the Board of Education special meeting November 29th, 2021?
So moved.
A second.
Hold on. His name's not on the roll call for that meeting. For the 29th.
Are either of us for the 29th?
For the 29th special. I'm so sorry. I have your minutes.
That's okay.
That's because this is the meeting that they got sworn in.
Oh, and
then they're there.
Yeah, you should go.
Sorry.
All right, so, okay, any discussion? Okay, roll call, please.
Who first?
Oh.
Craig, and then?
Heather.
It's always alphabet.
No, she was asking.
No, I was first and second.
Oh.
Yeah,
who first? Right, that.
Oh.
Craig, Moe, and second.
I second.
Okay. Director Blackham?
Yes.
Director Booth?
Yes.
Director Frumkeller?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Yes.
Director Olson?
Yes.
Great. May I get a motion to approve the minutes from the Board of Education special meeting December 3rd, 2021?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. Roll call, please.
Director Blackham?
Yes.
Director Booth?
Yes.
Director Frumkeller?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Yes.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes from the Board of Education special meeting CASB conference December 2nd through the 4th, 2021?
Second.
So, yeah. Did you get that? Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Blackham?
Yes.
Director Booth?
Yes.
Director Frumkeller?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Yes.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right. Okay, now we'll move on to communications. We have Mr. Ken Schumann.
Hello.
It's the table's yours.
Thank you.
The show is yours.
It's nice to see all the new directors on. So it's this is going to be my first presentation. You may have seen one of them before, but I was trying to think about what should I do this evening that would make it at all interesting to you. So if the veteran...
I didn't know you danced.
Yeah. You have to throw a little sand on the table. If the veterans will indulge me, a lot of this is for the new, for the new directors. And I was thinking, what can I, you know, I want to tell you a little bit about what I do and what my function is here. And so I thought the best way to do it was to, and I'm not going to go through it in detail, but print up a job description for my position. And I highlighted in yellow some of the things that take up more time than some of the other things. So that when you have a chance, you can look at it if you want to know a little bit more about what I do. I do work by myself, although I work with five other people down in the building down below. But I am the HR person for the district. And I do work closely with Tammy Myers. And you know Tammy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Tammy is our benefits and payroll specialist. So she and I interact a lot. And she actually trained me in a lot of my job when I first started. So I just included this so that you can kind of get a little better idea of what I do and some of the things that I bring forward to you as a board. Obviously, what I do more than anything is recruitment, hiring, and onboarding of new employees. That takes up a lot of my time, particularly in the summer. When things start to slow down for most of the district, things ramp up for me towards the end of the school year and throughout the summer. And people like Ron, me, Marty, and others that are back there, we work year-round. So my busy time is during the summer when we are recruiting, hiring, not only certified, meaning licensed staff, teachers, special service providers, but also our classified staff, our custodians, our special ed paras, positions like that that are non-licensed. So I spend my summer really working quite a bit on recruiting and hiring. I also do onboarding of new employees. We're a small school district, so I have the luxury of meeting with every new employee personally when they come in to go through their new hire paperwork, to explain their benefits to them, policies and procedures and so forth. So that's also a big part of my job. So I did tell you that my busiest time of the year is in the summer. So I have to take my vacations during the non-summertime, and it works out really well. I've been with the district for, I'm finishing my ninth year, I'll be starting my tenth year in January next month. One of the things that we do as a district is to try to make commitments to our employees for the next year as quickly as we can. Usually, in fact, almost always now, before they leave for the summer, they have a contract in their hand for our licensed staff that they can sign and get back to me. And our classified staff have what's called a notice of assignment for the next school year. It all has, if there's a raise, a pay raise given, it's all reflected on those. And so we make sure that going into the summer, they know that they've got a job with us for the next year. And that usually happens during the month of April. So for me, things really start ramping up before the new school year, before the summer starts. I've also included for you a couple things that I wanted to talk to you about. For the new directors, I gave you a little pin. It's our newly designed pin that we give to our employees, our new employees, at the beginning of the school year, and to employees that have hit milestones, 5, 10, and 15-year milestones in their time with us. And so I wanted each one of you to have one of those. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that ceremony, because I hope you can all make it this year. I gave you a brochure from the last one in August. So you have a brochure in August, and we put that together, and it's the one time of the year that all of our employees can get together at one time. So we start with a luncheon, and then we have what we call our pinning ceremony, where we introduce the people that have been with the district for a certain number of years. We present awards to those that have been here 25, and 30 years, which we do have. And it's a real festive occasion, and it's well-received by our employees. And then sometimes Douglas will have a presentation to do, or bring someone in to do a presentation. But that's the one time a year that all of us get together. So it's really fun. It'll happen again this August. We'll put the new brochure together. Hopefully, and you all will be invited, and I hope you can make it because it's a really nice occasion. I included for you a handbook for the three new directors, an employee handbook. It's not real exciting reading, but it is, yours is right there. Yeah, it's what we give to all of our new employees when they come on. It has really great information about their employment with our district. And so it not only includes some policies, but it includes all kinds of information about benefits, about time off, about leaves, all kinds of things. So we encourage them to read through that. And that might be helpful to you to learn a little bit more about kind of how the district operates. Finally, I wanted to talk about a few other things that may or may not be reflected in the job description in terms of what we do out of human resources. I'm also the Title IX coordinator. So if there's an issue that comes up in the district, of discrimination, I will get involved in if there's a specific charge made, I will get involved and do an investigation and present my findings, and then it would be up to management at the schools or at the departments, perhaps along with Douglas, to determine what the outcome would be. But I'm kind of the fact finder in those kind of situations. I'm also the workers' compensation coordinator, so if an employee gets injured on the job, it's my responsibility to get them to a doctor to manage the workers' compensation claim. We have a list of four clinics that our employees can go to of their choosing. And so I monitor that process, and I also work with the insurer for us, which is Pinnacle. They're all over the place out here. So I do coordinate all the workers' comp claims and so forth that come through. I'm the HIPAA privacy officer. I really don't have a lot to do with that, but that is part of my official duties and so forth. If there's any issues regarding the confidentiality of medical information. Ron and I work very closely together on renewals of our benefits every year. We have a broker that we've used for many, many years that's done really well for our district. And we get an employee group together in the early spring to get presentations from our broker on options for health, dental, vision, and life insurance each year. And we work together as a group to make a recommendation to Douglas as to what we're recommending for the next year. So that'll be coming up in the spring. I talked about the luncheon and penny ceremony. That's a real fun thing that I get to work on every year. And then finally, Douglas and I meet with two employee groups every month to 2 months, depending on the group. One is the Teacher Advisory Council, or TAC, and it's a group of teachers that we meet with on a monthly or bi-monthly basis. They bring issues forward, and we discuss them. Sometimes we get some really good suggestions, a number of which we've implemented in the past, and it's really good to have that contact with the teacher group. They represent their peers in their buildings, and they get information back and forth to us, back to their peers, and that's a really good group. And we have representatives from each school on that committee. And then we have the classified advisory committee, our non-licensed people, our paraprofessionals, our custodians, our office managers, and so forth, that we meet with also periodically for the same reason. Both of those are really good committees. And the good thing, again, about that being a smaller district is Douglas attends those meetings, and I attend those meetings. And I think that's a real good way of establishing a good relationship with those employee groups. And so
how often are they?
What's that?
How often are they?
Well, we're doing the classified advisory every 2 months now, I believe. We're doing the teacher advisory every month, I think, still. Yeah, we're doing that every month. We just had one last week. Yeah, yeah. So those are just some of the things that come out of HR. And again, the people that I work with downstairs are Ron and Ron's staff, and then Mike has joined us, and we're there now. Mike Newton has joined us. And that's all I have for you tonight. I just wanted to let you know that I'm around if you you have any questions or anything, I'd be happy to answer. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's terrific.
We'll see you in August at the pinning ceremony.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks.
We need a date, and we can put it on our calendar.
I'll get the date. Yep. I will get the date to you.
All right.
Hopefully you'll see each other before that.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
You'll see me every month, whether you want to or not. Okay. Because, one of the things is that there'll be some heavy signing of contracts and notices of assignment in May of this next year. So you'll be busy.
Yeah, Craig.
And Craig, you'll be busy signing. Okay, so you'll really appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. All right, Marty, you're up.
Good evening. So, Shin and I didn't coordinate or anything, but I'm also here to tell you a little bit something about what I do, but I didn't print anything out as far as the job description is concerned. I have like show and tell items for you. So that you can visualize what my staff and myself and my department do for the school district. So obviously this is the first point of contact that you guys all see and know about, and that's computers, right? That whether that's staff computers, whether that's the Chromebooks that our students use, I think we've mentioned here, I'm not sure if you specifically know, been in a meeting where we have a one-to-one program in the district, means one computer per student, and those are Chromebooks that we use. We started that just a year ago. And so everything that has to do with a computer, we support, whether it's physical, like there's something wrong with the computer, broken screens, etc., or there's something software-related in there, or there's network-related issues. So we are all living in a world that has Wi-Fi. You guys know what Wi-Fi is. You probably have Wi-Fi at home. So how does that connect? Here's my little box. So
are these handouts?
These are not handouts. Some of these cost lots of money. Does anybody know what this is?
Router. It's an access point.
It's an access point. Thank you.
That's what I'm
saying. So, so you'll see we have about 85, 90 of these in our district. They're all mounted, usually somewhere like that. And this is what provides our Wi-Fi. So all of our devices connect to here, and that's how you get to the internet. But what I think most people, or maybe some people, don't understand is that ultimately there are wires that get connected to this. Whether it's your cell phone, right? Your cell phone connects to cell phone towers. Those cell phone towers are connected to wires. And we have this big infrastructure in the country that's connected to each other. Usually it's fiber optic cable, if you have heard of that term before. It's all over the place. And so when you see this, so we support this as well. Anything that goes wrong with these access points, software-wise, hardware-wise, etc. And so this is what one of the things that we worked hard to improve last year during the year of our pandemic, when we were doing a lot of Zoom synchronous learning, we had to really hone that in. It was one of those things where we were heavily depending on, and we had some issues in the beginning that then we had to work out. And so each one of these then is connected. Let me pull out my bag. There's wires. They're all different colors. This one happens to be purple. These connect to these wires in the back. And then somewhere in there through the building, they all go to somewhere. And then they get to these things right here. You guys know what this is? This is a switch. So this is basically...
It's a headache.
Yeah. It's a headache, yeah.
That's a headache.
And so this goes all over the building, and at some point, probably in a closet somewhere, in each wing of the building, this goes down, it gets plugged in. And so now you can start to see where the connection goes through, right? Wireless through here, all that data goes through here. So then we support this. If there's something wrong with this, if there's something wrong with the cable, we have to support troubleshooting. We have about 50 of these in various places, okay? And then ultimately this has to go to a place where it gets out to the internet. So our provider is called Zayo. So they, for the longest time, we didn't have fiber coming out to Elizabeth. They ran fiber for us because we took them on as a provider back in, I forget when, 2017. And so they actually laid cable down 86, from Parker down that way. And so you can start to see kind of where our internet goes. One of the early problems we had, because usually fiber optic cable is a small cable, there's a lot of construction going on. What happens? They dig up the construction, and then they sever the cable, and there goes our internet, because there's only one coming into the district. Where if you live in Denver or any of those areas, there's multiple points that the data can get into a district. So if that happens in one area, usually it's not a problem. For us, it becomes an issue until more and more providers come out here and start to lay the cable. And so then this gets connected to something that then goes out to the internet. So in the case of our new building in the high school that's going to house our certified nurse assistant, like these are the things that we're working on right now. How do we get that building that just got plopped down over there, how do we get it to the internet? Well, these are the things that we work with. You know, there's a lot of different options. We are connecting that building to the rest of the high school via a wireless. So there's going to be in the building these little antennas that are going to point to each other because that's more cost effective than tunneling something on the ground, laying conduit and cable, etc. The other thing too that I don't know if you realize or don't know is that we also support these. These are phones. And so all of our phones run on our network. So they also have a network cable. It goes somewhere.
Different color.
Yeah. Usually, yeah, so we do. Actually, it does make sense. Because for us, when you go into these cabinets, you'll see a bunch of different color cables. And we have it color-coded. So like blue's for phones. And I think red is for access points. So that we know which one it is. And we have these network diagrams, etc. But so we also support the phones, because our phones are all network connected. They're not kind of your old telephone system. I'm sure some of you have what they call voice over IP at home. If you have an internet provider, then that's how you get your phone. And so we support anything and everything in between all those points as a department, from software to hardware to Wi-Fi to infrastructure to the internet. We have staff. We have Mike Scobie, who's our network administrator. He's been working here for 25 years, I want to say. That's been here from the beginning, from when our high school was built. And so he makes sure that all this stuff works. We have three staff members, Sam, Seth, and Brian, who support our school. So they are the ones who mostly support this piece, and they're the ones who troubleshoot on this piece. And we have a student data specialist, Shelly Scobie, who you might have met because she was here to do the notary, right? Mm-hmm. And so she's our data specialist, so she's in charge of doing all the data for the district that's required of us through the state. Like our, I can't think of some, we have like our October count that gives the state our official enrollment. We have our, Douglas, I'm sure you can split out some of those, all those
Does
things.
She still do a lot of the assessment?
Yeah, she did. That's where we do the assessments in the spring. A lot of that data comes from the data that Shelly works with in uploading to the state, etc. So that's kind of generally, in a nutshell, what my role is. So it's not necessarily just kind of the educational component. What's different about us as being a small district is that in bigger districts, usually you have a director of technology, information technology, and this is all they're kind of concerned about. And then you have a director of like educational or instructional technology, and they're more concerned with like the software, the tools that the kids and the teachers use, and how do they use it more effectively, and what kind of PD should we do, et cetera. And so for us, I fulfill both of those roles. In fact, my official title is director of instructional and information technology, although I always think director of tech. And so this is my eighth year here. Yep. I started in July 21st of 2014. It's easy to remember because July 21st is also my wedding anniversary.
It's how he remembers his wedding anniversary.
Yeah, exactly. Today's my anniversary. Oh, that's my, I gotta call it. And we have a staff of six. Like I said, so three who support our schools. Staff five. Three who support our schools, one who supports our network, and one who supports our student data. That's all I had. The one thing, too, also, that I wanted to share with you, this is part of my
my job here is to make sure that we're kind of keeping up with Joneses, so to speak, in terms of technology. We're a rural district, obviously, and so we want to still ensure the best education possible for our students and give them an opportunity on the computer science side of things. And so we have we started a computer science curriculum through code.org, K through 12, and so I think this is our fourth year now that we've had that curriculum in place, and so it was able to give us like a computer science, an AP computer science course at the high school, which we didn't have before previously. And the other thing too, one of the things I wanted to share with you, right before March of 2020, around January, February, we started a Girls Who Code clubs in both Running Creek, Singing Hills, and in Elizabeth Middle School. I don't know if you're familiar with Girls Who Code. They are a nonprofit organization that wants to close the gender gap in computer science education. One of the stats they give is back in 1995, 37% of people who worked in computer science were women. In 2017, it was 24%. And it's I think the latest one is projected to be 22%. And so Girls Who Code is a program where they try to promote computer science in girls, because that middle school age usually is where they start to drop off. They're interested in that, and then they see that not a lot of women are going to that field, so they kind of drop off. And so we're starting that up again. We've been able to, lucky enough for a parent volunteer to start up a club for us at Singing Hills. One of my staff, Shelley Scobie, and one of the teachers at the middle school, Lisa Mullen, is going to run their club there. And then Sarah Sikirski, who's the STEM teacher at Running Creek, is going to run the club there. So we're excited that we're going to get that off the ground again. It was exciting to get it off the ground back in January 2020, and then COVID happened, and it's like, and then we haven't been able to get it off the ground again, and so now we're doing that as well. That's all I have for you tonight. Any questions for me or comments?
Marty, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's a good lesson.
Thank you for indulging me.
All right, next up is our district nurse. There she is.
I'm here.
Come on down. Over.
You can tell us what you're doing.
Oh, I'm going to. Hi there. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Lori Clark. I'm the district nurse here, and I came from 23 years at Children's Hospital before I came here. I started in January of 2016. Thanks for opening the window.
Great timing.
You're the nurse. We have to.
Yeah. So my responsibilities are basically I'm accountable for the health of all the students, which means being involved, not necessarily hands-on. We have in each school, we have a health tech. And I train and delegate them under my license, so I kind of have to supervise everyone. We were fortunate enough, thanks to Douglas, to be able to hire an RN, also from Children's Hospital, my buddy. Her name is Brooke Newton, and she works at the high school part-time, so Douglas foresaw that I would probably need some help because of COVID. It's been my life for the last year and a half. So anyway, it's been great having her.
Thanks to Ron and Ken as well.
And thank you, Ron and Ken. Thank you. It's been a huge help for me. I also participate quite a bit in the special education process, making sure that kids with disabilities get their needs met. And also, I am the district 504 coordinator. So again, those are students with disabilities, making sure that they have appropriate access to their educational environment, and with the fact that they're dealing with a disability like diabetes or asthma or things like that. I am also the early childhood evaluation nurse. So we work with early intervention, Eastern Colorado Services, I always forget that, and they contract with us to do evaluations from children 0 to 3 who are identified as possibly needing services. So we have a team, our occupational therapist, speech therapist, me, and our preschool special education teacher. We used to go out to homes and do those, but now because of COVID, we have them come to one of the schools. And then also the 3 to 5 year olds, those are the kids that are getting ready to enter preschool, and if they're identified, we also evaluate those kids. And then if they qualify, they get a discounted fee for preschool. And then I'm also involved in policies around health for the district, and I'm also responsible for all the medical training. Our preschools need to be through licensing, they're required to have CPR, medication training, standard precautions training. So I do all of those with the preschools in addition to training for the health aides in all of the schools, and just teachers, because teachers have to be trained because they take kids on field trips. So we have to have medical training on any kids that go on field trips. And then I'm also, I'm responsible for immunization reporting to the state. The health department has, you can now get on their website and every person can see what each school district's immunization rates are. So I have to report those. And then, as I said, the last year and a half, my job has been COVID. I filled a lot. We developed with Douglas our guidelines and protocols around how we were going to manage, the pandemic, and it's been a lot of my job, phone calls and emails from parents pretty much on a daily basis, especially August through October. It kind of has slowed down quite a bit, so I've been able to do some other things. Our parents, I will say, have been really fantastic about the number one preventative thing is leave your kids home if they are sick or anyone in the home is sick. And we also, through the state, have had access to COVID tests. So that way, if a family member's homesick, we're giving out tests. Take a test home. Test mom. If she's negative, the kid can come back to school. So those have helped us, having those this year, getting kids back to school a lot quicker. The other thing is if the kid's sick, before we had this testing, we said you had to be symptom-free for 48 hours. Well, we have these tests now, so if the kid just has a cold, they test negative, they get to come back. Because in normal years, kids can be at school with colds, So we've got those. We worked a lot, Douglas, I should say, on our ventilation. We've purchased a lot of HEPA filters. Now we've purchased the bigger ones. We have a lot of smaller ones. We have the CO2 monitors, and those get moved around to different classrooms throughout the weeks and months. And our CO2, I'm sure Douglas will tell you, our CO2 numbers have been great. We have not mandated masks, and I'll tell you what, it's worked. I was surprised because I wanted masks, but it's been great, and the parents have all been pretty happy. They're frustrated. I think everyone is frustrated by this, but last year we were strictly following the health department and saying if someone in the home has COVID, you got to stay home for 14 days. Or if someone comes into the school with COVID, which inevitably happens, it's not a foolproof system, but if someone comes in with COVID, we were quarantining everyone around them for 10 to 14 days, and we haven't been doing that, and it has been great. I mean, I think we've maybe had spread 3 different times, and it impacted maybe 2 students each time, and it didn't go any further than that. So I did put together, if you were curious about our numbers, through November 30th, we have had, we have 1,920 students, we have had 183 students and staff test positive for COVID. 139 of them were students, 44 of them were staff. So that should tell you that, we inevitably are going to have people come into the building that have the virus, but that tells me that it's not massively spreading because what we're doing is working with the ventilation and the testing, I think. And that equates to 7.2% of our students. I don't know exactly how many staff members, I couldn't figure that out, but 7.2% of our students have tested positive. But, we've kept the numbers down. We haven't had a lot of spread. So I feel like what we're doing is working.
I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank you for everything that you've done. I mean, Douglas has been keeping us up to date in all of our meetings, and I know you have, and that's hard work. That's a lot of hard work and a lot of phone calls into the evenings. You know, it's
weekends.
Yeah, weekends.
But it's slowed down so much. I can't say that. I can't say that anymore.
But I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. There were some days I wanted to run out of here screaming, but for the most part, it's been very good. People are very appreciative, and most parents are too. I mean, I think the parents are just happy that we're able to stay in person. We're not quarantining a bunch of kids. You know, I sense that. And, you know, there are a few parents, but once you put it to them, like, we're trying to keep the schools open, you know, they really sort of back down. So, yeah. Any questions?
Thank you. Just want to clarify that I do this too. We talk about quarantining students. We never quarantined anybody.
Right.
We excluded them from work, or we excluded them from in-person learning. And last year, we followed the quarantine guidelines to make those decisions, but we didn't tell people what to do when they were outside of school. It was just a matter of health and safety within the school. We felt that was good within our authority. And so you needed to meet these conditions to be able to be in person. And if you didn't meet those, then you had to stay out until you met them. This year, we've done the same thing, but the only students that we, or staff, we've excluded are those that are sick. So if you're sick, stay home. Or if you have someone who's sick in the household.
Right.
But if you've been, say, for example, exposed in the school setting, we haven't made anybody stay home. Last year, that was the protocol that was pretty strongly pushed by public health. We in most districts followed that. All districts. But this year, because there were so few students who were excluded last year, so we had over 800 students who were excluded because of exposure in the school. Not because of exposure outside the school, but exposure in the school. And I think that there were possibly two,
that got it.
That got it, of the 800. So what that means is that there were 798 who were sent home for a period of time, unnecessary. And so this year we said, we are not doing that because that was unnecessarily disruptive to their education. And so we haven't been doing that this year, and we found that it's worked really well. The one situation where we found spread within the schools is when there have been two individuals with the virus at the same time, and that they're around other people for 3 to 4 hours. And this has happened twice, one at Singing Hills and once at the high school.
And they came to school sick, or if someone at home was sick.
With COVID?
Yeah.
Ended up
but there's two, because we've had all these other cases, the 135 or whatever, they've come into our schools, those numbers. They didn't get it at school. They came in with it. Or they didn't come in. Does that include just ones that tested positive and never came into school, or is that only the ones who came into our schools?
That is everyone who tested positive.
So that they didn't necessarily come into our schools. Some subset of that came into the schools.
This is students and staff. 114 students and staff came into the school with the virus, and we had two situations where students got it, relating back to one of those people. So
all of the rest of those came in with it, and it didn't spread.
Right.
And we were, it was another part of our protocol, was to really investigate and monitor, was anybody else getting it? We knew this student had it, and they had these classes. And then in the 2 weeks following, does anybody that was around them get it? And they did. They 100 and whatever that is, 14,
right.
Did not.
Right.
There were these two, at least that we know of, cases where there were people that were close that got it. And then we studied those. I mean, it took hours to really figure out, because we can summarize it now in 10 or 20 seconds, but we didn't know at the time what was going on. So we just had to say, what happened? What were they doing? know,
where were they sitting?
Who were they with? How long? And so forth. And in one case, we didn't even really know that the students and their parents were kind of claiming that they weren't positive, but every indication was that they were. And we had a lot of evidence for that, including a whole bunch of people that were close to them for a bunch of time getting the virus.
Well, and I think we also would, based on what we found, would make improvements. Like, do we need more HEPA filters in here? Is there the HEPA filter in the corner? Do we need to put towards the middle and another one over here? And, you know, we immediately would take the CO2 monitors to those classes and see what the CO2 is. So.
I think as a parent, a lot of people are appreciating that we, this year, get an email and we can make a choice, our own choice for our own children. Okay, am I going to send my child based on the email or am I not? And we have a choice, and I think that's the logical decision. Is it's just left up to whether they want to take an extra protocol and keep their kid home to do online learning for a little while or not. But I like, this year has been amazing.
That's good to hear. And we do. Every time we have a case that we find, of these 14, a letter will go out to either a grade at the elementary level to say, hey, a student was identified who tested positive. And that way parents can make a choice. And then I think at the high school level, they're just doing it by grade because those kids are all over the place, and middle school as well. We've made sure to be transparent and communicate.
So instead of waiting till later, why don't I'll add some of the CO2 information on the topic and so forth. So just to make sure that everybody understands, like, the relevance of CO2, that when we breathe, we expel CO2, and if somebody has the virus, they're also expelling the virus. The virus is airborne, it's transmitted either through droplets or through air, much smaller particles in the air. And so the risky situations are in enclosed spaces with poor ventilation over longer periods of time. Outside, if you're breathing, you have the virus concentration is dissipating very quickly. And that's why you see government entities having mask mandates inside and not outside, because now you see some having them outside as well. I don't know why, I just got a text saying that California has just done a statewide indoor mask mandate till January 15th. Which is really disappointing to me, because that's where I'm going for the Christmas holidays, is my family, and it just totally changed my prospects of having a good time. But anyway, but that's because in enclosed spaces that have poor ventilation, the concentration of the virus in the air can build up slowly over time, enough so that it can actually, somebody can actually get it, depending on whether they're breathing heavily, depending on whether the person that's, you know, There's a lot of science there that's been there since the beginning, but it's been amplified in the last year and a half around the world. So CO2 monitors are a proxy for the amount of kind of fresh outside air that's in a given space. And the higher the CO2 level, the less outside air, so to speak, or the potential higher concentration of the virus. And so the experts, these are aerosol experts, primarily, who've been talking about this since June of 2020. We learned about it in June, July. I would say, and I want to give a lot of credit to my wife, who was following this stuff, because one of the experts is from Spain. He's at UC Boulder, but he's from Spain. As is one of the ways to then understand what's going on in it. Given space is to be monitoring the CO2. And so we purchased a number of them last year, and then we purchased even more for this year to be able to move them around more. We didn't purchase one for every, I think they cost maybe $200, so it's kind of expensive. And it measures other things like radon and other things. But then there's an app on your phone, and our custodians move them around, track them, and then put the data into a spreadsheet that's shared by everybody. And that way we're, and they, what they put is the highest CO2 level recorded in that space. And the outside air has approximately 400 parts per million of CO2. So that's kind of your starting point. So if you're indoors and you've got 400, it's kind of like, it's like the outdoors.
Feels like the outdoors.
Sorry.
I agree with you.
It's a little chill in here because the numbers were going up.
There had to be a reason to it.
So I was opening. We don't want to take down all the leadership of the district here right before Christmas. Actually.
What are we at now?
Right now we're at 610. But it did get up to 900.
Okay.
And then I open the windows and it's gone right down. The experts recommend in the COVID context between 400 and 700 parts per million. And that means you're very safe. So the district, as some of you know, bless you.
Thank you.
Did a number of things with the HVAC systems to help have a greater quantity of fresh air and outside air and keep these numbers down by running them continuously. So not just on and off based on the temperature, which is how many thermostats are set. We run them before school starts until a little bit after. We opened up the damper, so we brought in 20 to 25% more outdoor air. They're running all the time. And those two things will show up in this. We did something else that won't show up in this, which is we added the recommended filters. The filters that will filter, I think, down to 5 microns or 3 to 5 microns. And they're called MERV. It's just an industry standard MERV 13s, and we were able to put them in all of our units. All of this, always on, during when it's occupied, the additional outside air and the filters puts more stress on our units. So we've had to maintain them more. It's cost us more in utilities costs, maintenance costs, not just maintenance in terms of time, people going up and checking and fixing things, but getting specialists in to help us fix it. If you're from 700 to 1,000, those are still decent numbers, but the recommendation is that you have supplemental air filtration, which are the HEPA air filters, which have been studied by NASA and many others to filter out that size particle. Building experts say, you know, just for normal circumstances, under 1,200 is a good number. But, so if you're seeing numbers in the 2,000 or 3,000 parts per million, that's not good air circulation. There are schools in the country where parents have sent their kids with CO2 monitors in their backpacks, and they're measuring those numbers. And there's a defensiveness on the part of the school district because it's something that's costly. It's difficult to change. Whatever. But our numbers, I want to give you some of our numbers. So this school year, we've taken 1,268 readings as of last week. 1,268 readings throughout the district. There's been 75 days of school. I've got the median. The median is different, too much different than the average, but we understand average better. And the average has been 594.
Wow. Okay.
That's been the average. 80% of the readings, 80% of the 1,268, have been below 700. So, you know, you can kind of think of it as, you know, any classroom on a given day, the highest it ever got, over 80% of the classroom days was 70. 10%. Were between 700 and 800. So you add those, so 90% were under 800. And then, a little bit finer detail here, 8% were between 800 and 1,000. And 2%, or 20 times over the course of those 75 days and 140 classrooms, the measurement was between 1,000 and 1,400. And very often, when that happened, there was a problem with the HVAC unit, and this alerted us to that, and then they got fixed. And even 1,400 is not a bad number. It's not our target, especially because we have the HEPA air filters in addition, and because many of our teachers will get, especially at the high school, will get the students outside and help them along. And so not only do we have, you know, we can tell you this is what we've done for air ventilation, not only can Lori talk about how many kids kind of got the virus and brought it in, how many had the virus and just stayed home, and approximately what kind of spread we saw within the schools, very low, we can also validate from a different perspective what's the air quality, rather than just here's the things we did to improve it, here's a way to measure whether those things were working. And I think, you know, these are numbers that we could, and I think we're planning to publicize and say, this is the result from the semester. This semester, we didn't know what would happen. We didn't know last year. Everybody was very safe, but we were all masked. That was the state requirement. Everybody everywhere in schools was masked. So not being masked this year, we didn't know how much of a difference it would make to be unmasked, which is why we bought more HEPA filters and why we bought more CO2 monitors, and we made sure that all of the ventilation protocols were kind of firmly in place, because it could have been that it didn't work as well as it needed to, but it did. And also the testing helped us validate. We had, because they were free rapid tests, we were able to get information. We've given out over 1,000 of those. I kind of stopped, lost count about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
And the other benefit to those is if we have, that we were kind of slow in the beginning for getting regular shipments, but you know, if a family, if the kids have it and mom and dad want to test, if we have enough of them, we're giving them out. So it's another nice thing just for family members to have of our students.
Are we still receiving them?
Yes.
Because I remember at one time that
we were running low. Yeah.
We got 96 today, and then we're going to get a lot more by the end of the week of the tests that have the telehealth component. So some people want or need the telehealth piece to it, and so we'll get a bunch of those. I think that the state has a whole bunch that they expire in about 3 months, and so they're providing them to rural school districts, as many as we want, and so we've made a big order for that to have those.
Just the more the better. That way, you know, if family members need them, we can give them out. There were probably 4 or 5 times where we were running low and we weren't able to do that.
To give everybody in the household. And if folks aren't comfortable using the telehealth, they can still do the test.
Using that kit.
Either one of those. The state's really encouraging people, to both us and individuals, to let them know when they test positive. That's their thing, but that's a personal choice. Some people are comfortable and some people aren't. So I'm going to close some of the windows because it's now down. This does do temperature. Right? This should be fancy enough.
Put it down on the floor.
It says 72 degrees.
This cool floor.
Well, it's probably 72 here, but yeah.
He's like, my legs say differently.
It's now down to 572.
Nice.
So you can see it's
wherever the hot air
tracking. So,
say it louder, Craig.
I am cold.
Thanks for hearing that, Rob.
I got to close down a little bit.
All right, any questions for me?
Watch your finger.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Lori has been our secret weapon because she's really got great, I don't know what you call it because it's not in a hospital, but bedside manner. She's super helpful. I've been in there countless times, whether when she's on the phone with people, and she just helps them, and they ask her questions, and she gives them advice, and I think that's made a huge difference, that they can call somebody, because we keep, every time we send a message, call Lori, so our staff call her, parents call, and she just talks them through it. They'll go, well, what if it's positive everywhere? We'll deal with that. Just call, do this now, and then we'll go from there, once you've done this. And I think that I don't know what we would have done without not only Lori, you know, somebody in Lori's position, but the way that she's handled it, and been very reasonable with families and explaining.
Much appreciated.
Thank you.
All right. Next is our safety update. Mike, you want to come on up?
Absolutely.
Tell them how you know your situation at Singing Hills.
We'll hold off on that one. Unless you want to.
Yeah. Just funny.
That it is. Well, I'll start off that one. Thank you for having me here tonight. For everybody, my name is Michael Newton. I'm the new Director of Safety and Emergency Planning for the school district. A little bit about me, just kind of quick overview. Prior to this, I was the Assistant Director and Director of Security for Littleton Public Schools. This is my fourth year in public education, all in a security kind of role. Prior to that, I was active Air Force for 4 years, Security Forces, stationed in Texas. Moved back out here, active guard for 2.5 more years, and I'm still a traditional reservist. Just promoted E7 senior or master sergeant, so that's a huge milestone in my career. Happy about
nice.
That.
Good for you. And thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So this is actually my fifth week on the job. Honestly, hit the ground running, and I didn't bring anything to show and tell for everybody. Marty kind of set the bar pretty high on that one. And I don't have handouts, Kent, but I do come with information though. So really, I'll kind of break down my job as really, as it kind of explains, safety and emergency planning. Kind of encompassed inside that role is security as well. And really what that is I kind of look at it from the safety and security mindset, where we also have security technology. And part of that role is I came into a $300,000 school safety grant that the Board of Education had approved when my predecessor was in this role. Ron knows all about the Federal Cops Office grant, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for his help on that. But part of that grant provided really just the ability for us to harden our school security, as well as video surveillance, access control, and mass notification. So with the funds from that, we're going to completely overhaul our video surveillance systems district-wide. So we'll be moving to a unified security system, as well as our access control. So the huge benefit of that is the systems will be tied together, and so they'll be communicating together 24/7, 365. And my big push, and really kind of my vision for this, is uniformity and consistency district-wide for all schools. You know, we're a small enough district where the students in both elementary schools go to our middle school go to high school. So practices, procedures, policies all need to align district-wide just to make sure that we're all on the same page and everybody understands the basic expectations. You know, I am a department of one, but really I have a department of hundreds, because the best asset we have are the staff members here district-wide that work with our students day in and day out. Really, like I said, the grant was the big one, and kind of going through, I really conducted a kind of security assessment, and I kind of shared some of that information to Douglas. And really what that is it allowed me to kind of sit down and prioritize what do we need district-wide, how can we allocate resources for the best, you know, cost-benefit analysis. You know, money's not infinite in public education, we're all well aware of that, so it's about getting the best return on the investment that we have. How can we really impact our students' lives and ensure that they're the safest they can be without going above and beyond and really spending frivolously on stuff we don't need. So part of that, and the big push that we have, and this is really free, Standard Response Protocol, the I Love You Guys Foundation, the 2021 iteration of it, which kind of aligns, you know, practices and procedures, but really some of the terminology changed from lockout to secure. There was a lot of confusion back in the day between lockdown, lockout. Parents would hear it, are we in lockdown? No, it's just lockout. This is what that protocol means. So the terminology changed to secure, and along with that is the terminology hold. And really hold just kind of keeps students inside their classrooms, and it doesn't really, it permits or prevents them from going out into the hallways where you may have a hostile, not really hostile, but a medical emergency, an altercation, something of the sorts. It's just safer to keep them inside the classroom. The other component of that is visitor management, and really we're looking at increasing our visitor management processes and procedures district-wide, bringing back Raptor solutions, hopefully on a district-wide scale. Big part of that is, you know, we are a small enough school district to where we do know our community, we do know our parents, our visitors, but the big benefit from an emergency response standpoint is it allows us to kind of extract that information, share that with first responders if we do have an emergency and we have to reunify and evacuate the facility. That's critical information, and I'm a firm believer, allow the educators to focus on the education, allow myself to come in and assist with that safety component. We're here from an operational standpoint to really add an extra layer and kind of alleviate that stress with safety and security. And that allows me to have that information on it any given moment throughout the day. Additionally, one of the other kind of layers that we're looking at is increasing communication. Some of the communication is kind of going back and forth. Hopefully we'll apply for another grant come March timeframe. It's a free state grant, no match, no contribution. But it's pushed from the Colorado, it kind of came from the Governor's Commission from the STEM Incident, which basically promotes interoperability and communication on a district-wide platform. Yeah, like I said, really, just kind of hit the ground running, and I have to kind of bring up what happened at Signal Hills. So part of the process, we're working with one of our integrators here. I don't even think Douglas knows the story yet. I promise it's positive. I promise it's positive. You know, really, like I said, I'll start with this. Coming into this role, you know, you kind of hit or miss with, you know, a lot of students, staff, members, but everybody here in this district is invested in safety and security. Everybody understands it's part of their role. It's not just mine, but it's a collaborative input. And really, through consensus, we're able to come to these good decisions as to how to move forward. And part of that is Signal Hills. I was kind of going around checking security doors to kind of see where we can have our investment in access control systems and where to add it. I was like, I have 30 seconds. I'm going to be in and out. Went around the back. I made the mistake as a safety director not to check in at the office. Lessons learned. One of the office staff members was following me on the cameras, coordinating people around the school to try to intercept me as I came back through because she couldn't tell. She said, I think it's Mike, but I'm not 100% positive. So it was an awkward kind of confrontation where, that's Mike. He's the safety director. Wait, it's Mike. And I'm like, you passed with flying colors, A's all around. So
this was a test.
It was, and they passed.
But really, that is a good thing to see how that they were following you around. I mean, that is fantastic to see.
And that kind of loops back in, Marty undersold, really the integral role IT has here, the entire security infrastructure, as he kind of went around the switch access points, that's the backbone of the system, IT. There's no way we'd be able to operate that system if it wasn't for IT and the, you know, infrastructure integrity that we have. But yes, coordinating me, following me from every single camera as I went around the facility, it was impressive to see and extremely reassuring that if there ever was kind of a breach of security or safety,
absolutely,
that our staff members are on top of it. They know how to coordinate, communicate, and go back to the basics, but all positives. Lessons learned, check in, especially at Signal Hills Elementary.
So I'm just clarifying, are you the SRO then?
No. So, great point though. So, I'm the kind of, best way I see myself is a liaison for the school district. So,
okay.
Obviously civilian personnel, I work for the school district, full-time employee, just in charge of the safety department and emergency planning.
So then you work closely with the SRO, I'm assuming?
Correct.
So why don't you, because that was one thing, just to talk about partnerships with other agencies.
Absolutely.
And so kind of answering your question about SRO, but really blowing it up.
Yep, no.
You know, what's he's been talking about his internal role, which is a big part of it, but there's also another huge part, which is partnerships with folks outside of our school system.
Yep. No, that's a great question. And like I said, really my role, I kind of see it as the liaison between the school district and first responders. So on a day-to-day basis, I communicate with Elizabeth PD, I work with the fire department, I work with the sheriff's office. And the benefit of being a smaller school district, smaller community, is the actual sheriff is involved, the chief police involved, the chief of the fire department's involved. And you don't get that at larger, you know, departments and agencies. Coming from Littleton, working with South Metro and much larger jurisdictions, you just didn't get that really sense of camaraderie that we have here. So really, I coordinate with them, work with them. Any security questions, concerns the SRO may have, how can we kind of enhance their response capabilities, but also work with the fire department, everything from fire drills, fire code, making sure all of our schools are meeting fire standards, mass notifications. And one of the things that I love here is the fact that our drills are conducted with everybody. It's not pulling teeth, it's not trying to get everybody here. People want to be here. The first responders want to be a part of our schools. They're invested. A lot of them have students in our schools, so they understand the importance of that. So we'll do fire drills with 5-6 firefighters, the sheriff's office, our school resource officer, who is a sworn full-time police officer through Elizabeth Police Department, and he is rotated between the middle school and the high school, divides his time between the two of those. Really, the SRO and myself, especially in my prior role, kind of become best friends on the job. He's my point of contact for everything during the day. And vice versa. If he has questions, anything safety, security related, school related, he usually goes to me as a point of contact to help share and disseminate that information. And like I said, benefit of this district, and really is a breath of fresh air. The best part of my job is not being in the office, but being in the schools, working with the students and the staff. I've already gotten a few texts saying, wow, you're really not an office body, are you? And I love the business office. great people down there, but I love being in the schools. I love working with students. I love working with the staff members, and truly that's where we find out what needs to be done. I'll stop by school, and they'll be like, hey, I was meaning to ask you this question, which would have never came up had I not been in the school. But working with our elementary students, middle school, high school, it's the best part of what I do.
Can you talk about two other things? One is just kind of the prevention mindset that you have, kind of, you know, in a safety framework, there's response, but there's prevention. And then also, well, just to maybe share the story about, it was either your first or your second day, and singing hills again. They're so needy up there. and kind of how you helped them that day. I don't know if you remember.
Running Creek? With our little...
No, yeah, well, there was our little friend at Running Creek,
yeah.
Who we helped get back to class, but I was thinking about the electricity issue.
Yes,
and, you know, because we tend to think in more extremes about safety,
yep.
And that's why I wanted Mike to talk just a little bit about all those efforts and how relative, you know, how important prevention is, and then the other kinds of things that can happen that fall under safety. Maybe start there and then go to the prevention.
Yeah, and... Truly, safety, security, emergency planning is a very large umbrella with tons of branches that go off in every which way. And something I told, you know, Douglas and everybody kind of when I started in this role, I believe in a culture that really focuses on the everyday possibilities of something that can happen. Slip, trips, falls, errors, omissions, power outages. Because if you set the precedent and the expectation for what we should do during a minor incident, the larger incidents take care of themselves. People understand their role. But direct power outage occurred at Singing Hills, and it's just the coordination, the communication from the school to the district office to me to communicate back to the electrical company to get a time when it will be set back on. Worst case scenario, how do we provide the means to have electricity? When's it going to come? What about food? What are we going to do if anything spoils in the fridges, freezers? How are we going to coordinate stuff to get to the school if we have resources? And a lot of that just kind of trickles down, but it's really collaborative input, and everybody on the district leadership team is involved the moment something happens. But it kind of goes back to really my firm belief. Safety security is not just 100% physical security, cameras, access control. I believe in what I refer to as 60-40 split. 60% being security and 40% being the preventative intervention side, threat assessments. How do we intervene and provide capabilities for us to respond and provide supportive measures for students in the event an incident occurs? A lot of that stuff, you know, multidisciplinary teams working with myself, our school-based officials and administrators, the district side, and kind of intervening and working with students on a day-to-day basis to ensure that we don't ever get to the possibility where a major incident can occur, but also providing that positive culture for our students to really learn and be at on a day-to-day basis. You know, students, truly the most dangerous place they have, or I guess the school's the safest place they have, driving to home or from home to school is the dangerous thing they're going to experience all day. It's important for us to really disseminate that and share that with our students so they're aware that, hey, school's the safest place you're going to be on any given day, and we're here to provide the means for you to learn. And that's really what I base kind of my belief on school safety and how I really see my role in the educational field.
Great.
So, Ronnie Creek, that was a positive one. Yeah. I actually went there to get my photo ID. Ironically, it was a couple days after I started, and we had a preschooler who did not want to get a photo ID. He just kind of stood there, was not budging from the front door.
Stood there?
It was a little bit more than that.
Screaming yelling.
I was underselling it a little bit. But yeah, really,
I think he was on the ground.
He was. So
for a very long time.
Yes.
With another adult on the ground trying to coax him off the ground.
It's a team effort. And that's really the benefit of my role. Coming in from an outside perspective, it's just the students don't know me. So for me coming in as an outside person, more of the authoritative, they're a lot more receptive sometimes when they get to that point of, you know, escalation and how do they de-escalate. But I was able to kind of work with him, hold his hand. He didn't want to carry his backpack, so I burdened it and carried his backpack. It was actually kind of heavy, caught me off guard. So I carried his backpack, ended up getting the photo taken, and he had to say puppies, so I was up next. And the guy, I looked at him, I was like, do I have to say puppies? And of course, he goes, yes, you have to say puppies. Said puppies, and he wouldn't go back to class, so I walked all the way back to class with him and went into his actual room with him. So, like I said, that's the best part of the job.
You wouldn't go into the room without Mike.
Yeah.
You would not.
With me?
You would not.
You know, sure.
It was successful. Awesome. He was there all day after that. Yeah. So, and I haven't been back, so hopefully it's all positive.
But what you did for him was fantastic.
Yep.
And for the parents and the teachers and everyone there, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much, and it was nice to meet everybody.
You as well.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Yeah.
5 months later.
Yeah.
All right. So now, Mr. Ron, are you ready?
Yeah. Yes, I am. So, since everybody is kind of giving a rundown of what they all do here, I figured I might as well go ahead and start with that too. So, and I'll just kind of go back to the beginning of everything, of July of 2004, and I think the only two people here, Craig and probably Carrie, might remember those fun days. And so when I first walked in here,
So you started in 2004?
Yes. July 1, 2004. My job duties at the time, I was hired to be the finance director and also be ultimately responsible for food service. That was it. That was it at the time. But at the time, it was more of a, it was a handful because of the fiscal Titanic that I inherited when I walked in here. So along the way, I don't remember, my recollection's a little fuzzy, but along the way I also absorbed the responsibility of having the transportation director also report to me. That's also become my responsibility over the years. Then also, I forget what year it was, I think maybe it was 2005, 2006, the director of operations and maintenance got a little bit of some hot water and he left unexpectedly. And so at the time we had a director of operations and maintenance, and also somebody who basically oversaw the overall system of operations and maintenance in the district. And he also had somebody that saw the day-to-day of operations. His name was Brian at the time, and he basically was in charge of all the custodians and went on in the day-to-day basis of cleaning of the schools. And then when there was a little bit of a issue with the director at the time, the superintendent at that moment asked me if I would go ahead and take that position. And if I would have known then what I know now about the challenges involved, the septic system at Running Creek, Singy Hills, the latest issue of all of the finding out how to run our ventilation system, our HVAC system, and the nightmare that was to try and figure that out, and also other things such as contract custodians and things like that, I would have said, you know what, Rod, the time the superintendent was Rod Blunk, I would have told him, Rod, I think I'll pass on that. But here I am today, and we also then
No regrets. I can hear that in your voice.
Yes, none whatsoever. And obviously at the time we had lots and lots and lots of financial difficulties, and it took a while to get out of those financial difficulties, but it took many years to get out of those financial difficulties, even though when I walked in here we had a negative $2.5 million fund balance in the general fund, and it took a couple of years before we turned that around, but we did turn it around quicker than what we had originally anticipated. So that was obviously a good thing, but still, taking on additional responsibilities without extra pay was a little bit of, I'll take the responsibility because it's a challenge. And so, I took it on. And there was also times, I'm sure probably Marty's heard this, that I was even in charge of technology. And that, that was a unique responsibility, because I knew even less than any of, technology, and I'm sure people that have to work with me in technology will attest to the fact that I know very little, except I know where the any key is nowadays. So,
I want to connect something earlier to what Ron said before he didn't give me a chance to read, but when he talked about learning more about HVAC than he ever needed or wanted and having taken on operations, it would be known that he would learn so much about HVAC. He's not just talking about COVID, because a couple of years before COVID hit, you know this, Ron basically made a recommendation to upgrade the brains of our HVAC system and had to learn a lot in order to make that decision, and then also learn how to communicate about it to share it with me and the board and others in order to make a fairly large and important investment in a more sophisticated HVAC system that was more digitally controlled. If he hadn't done that, we wouldn't have been able to make the upgrades that we made for COVID. So we were able to respond quickly and to minimize the effort. And not to say that it was minimal, it was a lot, but it probably would have been impossible if we hadn't already done that. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, oh yeah, we talked about that, about how things fell into place that we were able to address to make last year not as financially difficult and the environmental issues in the schools too, that improved the environmental conditions in the schools because we had the foresight, not even thinking that something like this might be right around the corner. So, but yeah, but between closing Frontier, which saved us a ton of money, which with the reduction in funding for last year, we wouldn't have been able to make it happen. And along with the other, to be in the position we were in, be able to controlling the environment in the schools was dumb luck, I guess. I don't know. But we also were planning for, to make this change anyway, to make this improvement.
And it is foresight. That's what it was.
Like I said, it was more probably dumb luck. But so it's... I walked in, with $2.5 million deficit and literally a $2.5 million deficit, the fund balance in the general fund, and today we sit with $4.3 million in a positive fund balance. Took a while. Had some lean years, had some good years, and had lots of declining enrollment that made the job even more difficult because the enrollment at school is what drives funding for school districts. So,
I'm going to stop you for just a minute. He's being pretty humble because he was recognized by the highest levels of the state for the work that he did to get us out of that financial hole. And one of the reasons we're all able to be here today is because of the efforts that you put forth for us, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you for those kind words, Greg. I appreciate it. So that's kind of a little bit about what, some of my responsibilities, in addition to obviously finance and budgeting and all that other fun stuff, mill levy certifications. Before I get into the checks over 5,000, financial statements, a lot, mill levy and all that, I need to say that we still have regular paper checks that we send to our vendors for payments and that, but we don't have anybody actually signing them. They're all, it's automated, it's printed with signatures on it. And the two signatures I need to get tonight, and I left the paperwork downstairs, but I need the president's signatures and the secretary's signature on these pieces of paper. And so I'm going to need you to, there's going to be three pieces of paper that all say the same thing, but it's for you have the ability to sign your name multiple times until you like your signature. It goes under the check. So that's what that is. So I just needed to make sure I pointed that out. I don't think I gave that to you, Kristen. Did I give you those? Okay, I just did it. My memory is not as good as it once was. So didn't know if I did or not. So going into checks over $5,000. Which is in your packet, and what we do is we give you a list of checks that we wrote over $5,000. These are checks we actually do cut, and we have there's a lot of recurring payments that happen every month. Checks to, now it's called CORE, it used to be called IREA. I forget what the gas company is. It used to be Black Hills, Aquila, the gas company. We have those bills that are recurring every single month. Virtually every month, we buy different food supplies. That occurs virtually every month. Insurance, workers' comp, happens nearly every month. Even though it's for a 12-month period, we only paid over 9 months. So you'll see it for the first 9 months, but then you shouldn't see it for April, May, June. Let's see, and there's a few other things, fuel for the buses, things like that. And then there's the other ones, but those are all go on these checks over $5,000. But then what I share with you, what I talk about in the meetings, are checks that are outside the normal utilities and the insurance premiums. So with that said, this month's checks, and I'll just use the typical spiel. This month's checks have your typical monthly expenses, such as utility bills, foodstuffs, insurance, and fuel costs. Plus, there are payments for contractual SPED services, out-of-district tuition, Leader and Me supplies and membership fee, playground equipment, concurrent enrollment, and a reimbursement for the RISE grant to Big Sandy. Now, there is a brief description. You have who the payment's to, you have what the check was for, or how much the check was for, and then also a brief description. Now, the brief description, this is put together in the checks. There is a brief description in there. Yeah, they're very brief description of what the checks are, what the purpose was. But, so somebody in my finance office puts this together. I know a little bit about some of these expenditures, but if you have more in-depth questions about some of these expenditures, that would need to go. You could email me, or you could and ask me what the question is, and then I can find out the answer. But for I'll use this example for the concurrent enrollment. That is a product of what goes on over at the high school, and that is basically. Does everybody know what concurrent enrollment is? Concurrent enrollment is students who are high school students at our high school have an opportunity to go to a college, a local junior college around here, a community college, and get credit, college credit, but then also high school credit. And we have to pay a fee to the community college for these services. So they, like I said, they get credit for both, and I wish more students would take advantage of it because they could be graduating with some of them with a community or an associate's degree if they play their cards right. So, and graduate from high school at the same time. So that's just an example of what concurrent enrollment is, and there'll be other items on here that. It's like, that doesn't make sense. You know, what is that for? So if there's other questions like that, I might be able to answer them and give you more of a definition of what the expenditure is for or an explanation of what the expenditure is for, but there I might not.
Is there something, is that sent to us? Do we have a copy of it?
It's in the board package, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. I just haven't printed it out.
Okay. You mean when the thing Chris sent, the mm-hmm. email Chris sends? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's all part of that, and it's part of the financial statement also. So, with that said, any questions about any of these expenditures?
Is Leader in Me, I heard you say, is that a program, is that the program that elementary schools use?
Yes. Well, I think you can even go beyond elementary schools. I believe. I don't know if that is the case.
Yeah. No charges, just at the elementary level.
Right, yeah, these charges were just for what's going on over at Running Creek.
Oh, okay. Okay. Does Singing Hills use it? Utilize Leader in Me?
I was just curious. But they don't have the same charges. It's also used at the middle school, but they each do a different approach. Yeah. different.
Oh, okay. Different.
So would the principals come in and give an update of their schools over the course of the school year? So I think only one so far, right, Regina?
Yeah, they start back up.
So they'll come in. They'll typically talk about how they're incorporating things like Leader in Me into their curriculum.
Okay.
All right. So moving on to the financial statements. Financial statements. So the checks over $5,000 that you have in your packet are for expenses for the month of November. The financial statements are through the month of October. And the reason we don't do financial statements for the immediate previous month is because it takes so long to get everything reconciled for the revenues, and so that's why we don't provide that information, because it's such a quick turnaround, and the last thing we need to do is rush anything, and that's when mistakes happen. So, but financial statements as of the end of October, we are a third of the way, or 33.34% of the way through the fiscal year. Revenues collected are at 25.5% as a percentage of the general fund budget, while expenditures are close to 33%. Overall, general fund expenditures are under budget, and I always use where we are as a percentage of the budget for actual expenditures and revenues as a benchmark. So right now we're under budget in expenditures by 0.49%, or almost, 0.5%. So, which is, like being under budget for, at this time of year. And more than likely, I'm not going to touch that yet. But if you notice, the revenues are significantly under the 33%. And does everybody know why that is? Because of the nature of the beast of how we get funded in the state of Colorado. We get on a monthly basis pretty much the same amount of money from the state every month, but we're also relying a lot on property taxes. Property taxes get the major collection points are in March through June. And so right now, property tax collections trickle in. And these are mostly property tax collections that people are paying late. And so there's not a whole lot of money that's coming in. So that's why, as a benchmark, we're way under the 33% for the revenues at this point in time. And so that's one of the reasons why, don't want to go too far in depth with it, but one of the things that the state treasurer's office offers are interest-free loans to help us get by, because the months of January and February are very, very tight cash flow-wise. And so that's why they offer these interest-free loans to the state treasurer's office. We did not need to take advantage of it until a couple of years ago, and now we're taking more advantage, not more, but we're taking advantage of it, because one of the biggest reasons was because of the mill levy override, because that's one more component. We've increased our expenses for the mill levy override, but we don't get the money from the mill levy override until March 3rd. So that's why. When the taxes are paid.
Okay.
Yes.
And am I correct in that the money we get from the state depends on the money we receive from the taxes, correct?
No. The money we receive from taxes, that's one of three components of the overall School Finance Act, but it's less we get in tax money, property taxes, specific ownership tax, that's when the state has to make up the difference,
right.
And that's why it's called equalization.
Keep going.
Sorry.
Oh.
I was just asking, so I thought I had heard that the more we get in tax money from our county, from houses and stuff like that, the less
the state has to
help
right,
bridge the
equalize.
Gap or whatever.
Right.
Okay.
Subsidize,
okay.
Whatever you want to call
right.
it.
Right. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. I just was checking if that was correct.
Sure.
Right. So, you know, a lot of people thinking, well, we have all these houses coming in, so we should be overloaded with money, you know, is the thinking.
Right.
And, you know, come to find out a while back ago, that's horrible. A while back ago that, no, in fact, we don't just get all that money, then the state steps back a little bit in what
right.
they provide us.
They reduce the amount that they send us.
Okay.
Which then, and that's one of the reasons why they pushed, the state legislature pushed so hard last year, 2020, to go ahead and change a little bit of the mill levy rates. And that's why you see the 27% mills is what we had to get up to this year. And I am really hoping that CASB did a good job of educating on what the mill levy correction is all about.
We had that discussion, I'm not sure when, but we've had that discussion.
It was a prior ordinance,
yeah.
But we didn't have none of the meetings that we attended at CASB
talked about.
I was
going to
say.
That'd be great. Okay. No. Okay. Okay. You're right about that.
Okay.
The more money we get from local property tax collection, that means there's less money that the state has to help fund preschool through 12th grade education.
Okay.
Which then allows them to address other projects. Right now, a lot of it's transportation. Roads, bridges, things like that that are in desperate need of repair. So,
okay.
Yeah. The topic is really, I mean, it's hard to understand for people that have even been in a long time. But I'll just add that it's kind of a two-step process. The first step is that the state figures out through a very long formula which one can help everybody either learn about or be reminded of is how much the students in each district will get. So they'll say students in Elizabeth will get $8,500 per student, and the students in Douglas County will get $8,400 or something, and the students in Kyle will get $12,000. But the sources of that, for example, for us, the $8,500, part of it comes from state taxes, and part of it comes from local property. And the balance in every district of how much comes from the state and how much comes from local property taxes is all over the board. But you know that balance back and forth is really determined by the per pupil funding amount. And so every year, and I think Ron maybe has already told us about the governor's budget, and he's pleased because the governor's budget projects a fairly healthy increase in the per pupil funding overall, and that's the starting point for then where our money comes from. So, you know, the state's portion comes in equal chunks. The local portion comes all at the end of the school year.
Mm-hmm.
But those two things at the end of the year need to add up to the per pupil funding amount times the number of students we have. And it's the same for the charter school. Their money is just flowed through based on the number of students. If it's $8,500 per student and they've got 400 students, you do the math, and then that's what they get, minus a smaller administrative cost.
Thanks, that's helpful.
Sure. So also with the financial statements and the checks over $5,000, there is an consent agenda item on there to approve the financial report, and that's basically saying you're authorizing the payment of the checks that we are already cut. I know it's not the best system, but that's the way all school districts basically do it. And then also you also basically not approve but accept with the financial statements and the information in them. So with that said. And there's a lot of information in the financial statements, and it's somewhat overwhelming until you get your feet wet and you understand it. But I'll be open to questions and, you know, opportunity if you want to come on down and, you know, chat about it. And I can give you, I do a finance 101 training, and I have no idea how much Rhonda, Kim, and Carrie felt over the years having that.
It's good. It's different than banking.
School
finance is a lot different than banking. So
school finance
did a lot for me.
Yes, school finance is a lot different than other public finances and cities and towns and stuff like that. They're beholden to the sales tax and the Walmarts of the world. So, okay. Any questions regarding the checks over $5,000 or the financial statements? Okay. I'm going to move on to mill levy certification. So,
Ron's been preparing for this for like 3 months or more.
Yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah, well, yeah. So, you have, I don't know how many of you printed, did anybody print the mill levy certification? Okay.
I got it from Krista.
I want to share with you really quickly the cover memo. Each one of my action items usually comes with what's called at the top request for board action. It's a cover memo is what it is. And it just kind of gives you hopefully a decent snapshot of what this agenda item is discussing. And so I don't know how many of you have read in depth and got bored with reading some of this cover letter regarding the mill levy certification. But in addition to the cover memo, it also had a resolution in there. And this resolution is a template that Colorado Department of Education sent all school districts to use if they so chose. And so we did choose to use it. Well, I chose to use it. And for this upcoming tax year. Now, it says on the resolution that mills collected for the School Finance Act are the 27 mills, but it says mill levy per HB 20-1418. HB 20-1418 stands for House Bill passed in the 2020 calendar year, and 1418 is, well, they have lots and lots and lots of bills that get passed or introduced in the House. And so this is the 1,418th bill that was introduced in the House during that calendar year. What it said basically was that CDE made an error many, many, many years ago that told school districts, you've got to lower your mill levy rate when assessed valuations go up, because then you'd be over-collecting in taxes because of Tabor. Well, Supreme Court said that was the wrong interpretation, and we now have to fix that problem, because what's happening is we're spending so much money at the state level for school districts, we don't have a whole lot of money left for some other areas that we want to address in the state. So basically what they said was all school districts have to get to 27 mills or something reasonably close. Aspen doesn't have to get to 27 mills. Vail doesn't have to get to 27 mills. I don't know exactly what they have to get to, but they don't have to get to 27 mills because what they already charge for their mill levy because of real estate values in Pitkin County and Eagle, they're just astronomical. So they get a lot of money from the state, so they don't have to get to 27 mills. So what happens is you can only raise your mill one mill every year. Our mill, because we were so close to the 27 mills, only had to be raised 0.286 mills to get to the 27 mills. That is part of the cover memo here that says the mills for the for our School Finance Act for the operations is 27 mills. Also in there we have 5.781 mills for the mill levy override. Then the county also has, not just our county, all counties abate taxes for a variety of different reasons. Well, there was a tax abatement that we had to increase our mills to address the abatement of 0.016. It's a very small amount. However, we still need to make that a part of the mill levy certification. Good news is the total mills that you'll be approving tonight has gone down from last year. And that's because the assessed valuation has gone up so much. So the decrease was 0.359 mills that went down from last year to this year. So our tax rate went down. Assessed valuation for the property in the school district went up. Let me see my notes here. Went up 24.33 million dollars. Now, is everybody, should I get into residential assessment rate?
No.
Okay.
Not here and now. I think when you meet a few.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I think
that you can repeat that the more mills that we charge, if home values they stay constant, we charge more mills, we get more money. But as house values go up, on the standard 27, those mills don't go down. So from the state perspective, they're getting more money from local, because the 27 mills is being held constant, or for us it just increased slightly,
right.
And home values are going up, so there's more money. But Ron, the important thing that Ron said, one of them, is that our overall mills went down, even though we increased one of them, the general fund mill, from 26.7 something. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, 26.712.
To 27. But the total went down. Why did the total go down?
Because the assessed valuation went up.
No, but like where? Because it didn't go down on the general fund mill levy. It went down on the mill levy over.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, yes.
So we, the district, promised our taxpayers when we went out with 4A that it won't increase taxes. And that really had two aspects to it, but the most important one being that an individual homeowner wouldn't be paying more taxes on their house as a result of 4A over time. And so it's a fixed amount of money that we collect every year. If there's more people living in the school district, that amount that's collected is $1.59 million, is spread over more people. And therefore, their mill or their share can be reduced. So the actual mill that we certify is going down. The amount that they pay may also go down, depending on the overall kind of how much wealth, property wealth there is in the school district. Is everything right so far?
Yep.
But the important thing you want to see as a taxpayer, most of the time, is that your mills are going, staying steady or going down. Your taxes might be going up because your property value is going up. And so, in this case, as promised, the mill is going down, and nobody should be paying any more than they did ever before for the mill levy override. They will most likely pay more on their house for the general fund for two reasons. One, their property values may have gone up. They wouldn't have gone up since the last time, though, right? It should be.
They did go up because it was reassessment year last year. So it's two more years than they're going to do a reassessment.
So this time they will see a higher tax bill for the school district's general fund because the assessed valuation went up of their, the value of their house. Plus that 0.2 whatever it is increased from 26.7 to 27. And that amount, Ron knows by memory, for a house of $400,000?
$400,000 is $8.
$8. So we'll go up $8 because of that 0.27.
Wait, 278. Okay. Somewhere around
there. Did that confuse you, or did that help? You got it?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Sorry, I was navigating also the Google Drive.
Yeah, that's okay. It's just there's two things, you know, that are happening. One is the annual mill levy certification, and that requires a little bit of explanation. But, you know, on your guys' first time with that, there's also this state law requiring an adjustment in something that for years was always the same. It was just like, you know, standard thing. Well, everybody got it. But so we had to explain two things at once.
Right. And approving this mill levy certification tonight allows us to collect money not only for this fiscal year, this school year, but then it also is a portion of what's collected for the beginning of the following year, the fiscal year 22-23 fiscal year. That's the first half. So it's collected over a year, but it's for basically two fiscal years is what this is setting the rate for. So, and this, there's a third sheet that also came with this. And this is the sheet that also CDE generates for us. And it'll say in the middle column, it'll say Colorado Department of Education mill levy estimated as of November 30th. And then the last column, and they'll start out with the 27 mills at the very top. There's going to be a credit. We don't have a credit this year because the credit that we had last year has been phased out because we've raised our mill levy rate from the 26.714 to the 27 mills. The, go down a little bit farther, and they'll it'll show the total program mills, 27 mills at the fourth row. The fifth row is for voter-approved mill levy overrides and a few other voter-approved types of mill increases. And ours is the 5.781. You add those two together, along with the abatement I referenced earlier, and that gives you the 32.797 for the general fund on line 7. Underneath that is for the bond redemption fund. When we had bonded indebtedness, which the last we recently paid off the bonds that we used to build the high school, when we paid that off, we no longer have to calculate what the how much money we're going to need to pay to service that debt. So we don't have, just so you know, we don't have any bonded indebtedness anymore. That was paid off. So then you go on down and you see total altogether on line 12 is the 32.739 mills, gross assessed valuation, and a few other line items that will just, if I explain them, they'll just have further confusion, and it's really irrelevant to what we're trying to accomplish tonight. Any further questions on this piece?
Nope.
Okay. All right, next up, I got two more items. I'll do my best to try and hurry along as much as possible, but these are items I need to make sure you're aware of. Next month, I'm going to be bringing you a contract for your approval to install 15 rooftop HVAC units at the high school. And the reason we are replacing them is because for a couple of reasons. Since we are putting more stress on all of our HVAC units because we're running them more often, plus we went from I believe it was a MERV 7 or a MERV 8 filter in our ventilation or in our HVAC units to a MERV 13, and I don't know how many articles you all have read regarding what things that you can do, and even in your own homes, to improve ventilation in your house and filter out the viral germs that go through there in the air that introduce. It's put a lot of stress on our units. Those units are all over 20 years old, and they're past their life. Just because something is past their life doesn't mean they don't have any usefulness. But because we're putting more stress on them, we're running them more often. We identified 15 units that we should replace whenever we have enough funds. And we were planning on doing it over a period of time before COVID all hit. We were going to do this anyway, but years down the road. But when COVID hit, we had to speed everything up. So what we did was we sent out what's called a request for proposal to have these units installed on the high school. And these are using the elementary and secondary school emergency relief funds, or ESSER, as I've said many times. And I was like, I figured I'll tell you what the acronym is this time around. These funds are going to be used to improve the air quality over at that school, and also get units on the building that can handle the increased strain that we're putting on them. So we went out and did a like I said, the request for proposal, and we are going to be putting together a contract for the project. And just so you know, there's a unique feature that we have to include in this contract. We have to include language that addresses something called Davis-Bacon. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with Davis-Bacon. It's a federal act that says you have to have any contractor receiving any funds, federal funds, has to have paid prevailing wages for the area. And so that language has to be in this contract. So that's a unique component of the contract we have for this one. But I also wanted to let you know something unique because of the size of our district. We do not have any purchasing staff. We don't have anybody that's dedicated just for purchasing. So purchases, major and smaller purchases. No, not me. It's decentralized. Purchasing is decentralized. And why that's important to know is because there are lots of nuances that go along with purchasing requirements that are unique to government agencies. And so that's one of the things that we all have to do. It's, you know, I do it. Mark works on, you know, things for Mark Ressel, who is our transportation director, works on issues like for buses. We're going to be purchasing some buses, and so John, the athletic director at the high school, went out and got bids for a new scoreboard at the football field. So there's a lot of us all wearing these different purchasing hats throughout the district here.
That's awesome.
He picked that up.
Did he?
So the total cost for the purchases of the purchase of these 15 units, the labor and crane services, because these are massive units, we're going to need crane services, is going to be over $385,000. But we got feedback, and this is, I believe, a reasonable price. I still have to put it in the application that we need to send to the state to get these funds, but that's what these funds are for addressing lost learning and to improve the environment in the schools. So I haven't gotten approval for it, but I'm assuming that we're going to get approval for it. Last one, bus purchase. A few months ago, I shared with the school board that we need new buses. And because we've gone so many years without getting new buses, that they're just finding little quirks with buses, old buses that we've had for 30 some odd years, 35 years, and these roads, as you know, probably if you've ever driven them, are really bad shape in some instances.
No, they're fine.
So, we've got issues with our drivetrain and frames and stuff like that. So we need to get some new buses. Yeah. So what we're also doing is we didn't issue a request for proposal, but when some school districts issue requests for proposal, there's language in these requests that allows other school districts and other entities to piggyback on their request for proposal. And Academy 20 in Colorado Springs put out a RFP for buses earlier in the year, and we're going to use that. We're going to use their award as the basis for purchasing these buses.
So we're going to piggyback on theirs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And there is language in our purchasing policy that allows us to instead of using a full-blown request for proposal, to use cooperative purchasing agreements.
So we recently got some new buses, didn't we, in the last 5 years?
Yeah. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So
and we did the same thing.
Right.
With Littleton.
We use Littletons.
But we still obviously have several old buses.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Several.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So how many old buses do we have that need to be replaced?
Several.
So we've made a purchase of a bus, one here, one there, over the past 16 years I've been here. But that also means of all the ones that we need to replace eventually, there's a good 20 of them. We still have several buses that we purchased in the 80s who are still on the roads, but barely hanging on, and so, yeah.
And so the four is, or five, I guess, with the sped bus?
No, it's three general education buses and one sped bus.
Are kind of taking a bite out of that.
So there's four buses that sooner than later need to be done, like, now.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know how much detail you really want. I'll go through this really quickly. But transportation staff identified the best manufacturer based on their in-depth review and needs. And this manufacturer, this is one of the key points. Plus, this manufacturer has several repair facilities located in the area that we can take them to that can do regular warranty work and repairs that we can't perform in our garage. And that's very important, as I found out here with the buses we purchased earlier. Let's see, district staff is utilizing requests from Academy 20. The total cost for the four buses, based on the specs that Mark, our transportation director, requested, it's $442,000. Okay.
So you're gonna that'll come to us in a proposal.
Yes. Yeah, it'll. I'll also bring that to you next month. But yeah.
Would that be part of the budget revision?
Yes, it'll be part of the budget revision because we have to increase the capital line item in the transportation's budget to address this purchase. And where we're getting the money is we had a higher than anticipated general fund beginning balance for this year based on when I projected the beginning fund balance for the general fund to the tune of over $900,000. So we have more money than what we originally anticipated. And since this is a one-time expenditure, it's good to use this money that is not recurring. It's not a recurring recurring cost. And so, we can use these funds for these purposes.
A comment about the budget revision. So that end of January is a standard time the state gives districts to revise their budgets. It's an easy time period to do that. And it adjusts for a lot of the original budget is estimates of labor costs and utilities or whatever. And so what Ron does is two things. One, he chews up everything based on actual, and then he supplements or makes adjustments based on, okay, there are these projects, especially these things that we want to get done, say, within this fiscal year, like June, end of May, but like summer projects that we want to be able to, in between the school year. So the HVAC units would be that case. The buses, we probably won't use them this school year, but we will want to get all that paperwork done for the school year. The budget can actually be revised in March, in June, or even in July after the fiscal year is over. And essentially what the board does when it approves a budget is it authorizes spending to that amount. And then we manage. Some areas might be over budget, some might be under budget, but based on the funds, you guys have authorized the district to spend that money. And then the monthly reports tell you how we're doing relative to that budget. But let's just say there's a need or an opportunity, the budget can be revised, and the fundamental principle is we can only spend up to what you've authorized. But the January, end of January time frame is when districts typically, every district presents a revised budget that's more tuned to the actual and includes any of these other items like buses or HVAC units.
Plus, we also know we have got the final numbers from the October 1 count, and so we're going to know, we also need to adjust for any revenue increases or declines. And so that also needs to be reflected in the budget too, increases or decreases. And this year, in this case, increases in our revenues because it was higher than our projections. So.
Right. Okay. Must feel good to say that after all these years.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah. So thank you, the veterans, for indulging me in this.
Thank you. That was really good. Very informative.
Excellent.
Appreciate that. Took a little bit of Douglas's time.
That's what we were chatting about over here.
Oh, okay.
Did you see the time frame on here?
Yeah, that's right.
Douglas, you just say hi, okay?
Hi, Douglas.
Hey. So Douglas is yours.
So Carrie, is she the new Richard?
Yes, she
what?
Is. You know, it's like this. You got to roll your eyes.
You might be listening.
I wasn't sitting like that. If I was, I was cold. If she was.
Well, I will be brief.
No.
Yes.
Okay.
In January, maybe in the first meeting, we will present to you new courses that are being proposed at Elizabeth High School as a part of the Homegrown Talent Initiative. They've been really looking at what students are interested, what teachers are interested in teaching. So we will present that to you in January. I just wanted to give you a little teaser. That's right now, for example, we have started a CNA program, Certified Nurse Assistant Program. That will begin in January. Everything's on track, right?
Yeah,
it's crazy because it's.
I mean, there's some items that are.
There's a lot of
backordered,
supplies, but. And certification, but the space, and as Marty talked, and all that's coming together. That's an example. It's probably a more extreme example in that it took so much more to get that new course. We needed the space. We needed a certified person. We have all these hoops to jump through. Some of the other things won't be. They'll be. Offered in the course selection for students, but it needs to come to you for discussion and support before it's actually printed in that course catalog. And then if the students aren't interested in the class, then we won't offer it. But before offering it, we want to make sure that the board supported the things that we'll be adding. So that was one thing. The other is, and this is something that we talked about at the CASB conference, the district's strategic goals. We're going to put it on the website. It'll be under the About Us part. And just to note that we updated it a little bit. to be more reflective of the Homegrown Talent Initiative. So, for example, under key strategies and successful students, the first one is develop the graduate profile competencies. And we, instead of calling them vocational programs, we talked about career exploration and internships. So just a few minor wordsmithing kinds of changes. But we then put the graduate profile back, given that we referred to it on the front and because this is important. And we use this one, as Kristen was kind of pointing out, that it's not just the competencies, but it's a description of the competencies. And so that's there. This will be a
cool one. Look at it. They can say, what does that mean?
Competence reference. And in January, we're going to ask you to revise the policy for the mission statement. So it will say essentially what's here, and to add one of these key strategies under effective uses of resources, specifically the very first bullet there, to provide a safe and inviting learning environment through well-maintained facilities, transportation services, safety procedures, partnerships, and training. And that will be part of the official mission statement and policy, because that's a required thing to have a safety statement there. And it currently is not part of our language here or in the policy. So that's that. And then the last thing is just to, I think we mentioned this before, that the state has been kind of communicating that their state standards revision process that they go through every few years, depending on the subjects, they've been announcing their time frame for that process. Now, summer, there's been this commission that's been working for a while now, I think for maybe a year or a little longer, history, culture, social contributions, civil government and education commission report that I didn't open out in June, but it came out. They're, I think, getting feedback on this through sometime in January. I think they're going to make some revisions, and then sometime in the like late winter, early spring, it goes to the state board. And they'll talk about it with a target more or less in the maybe June time frame for them to approve this. I believe that what's new, aside from the introduction, I think, is when you get to the, it's on page 9, is where you see the recommended changes in red. And so I just want to share this with you. I mentioned it. We talked about it at CASME. And so there's there. And you can, if you're interested, you can contact Floyd Cobb, the Executive Director of Teaching and Learning, for more information. And then also, you can, and I can send you a link to the CDU website that outlines the process beyond what's outlined here and opportunities for input and feedback and so forth. So they are in this process of seeking feedback, but what I have found is that things like this are pretty yeah. And I've testified on things before, the graduation requirements or guidelines, they call them, and really, I don't know, you saw state board members not getting what they wanted from individuals from the public. Joe probably goes as far as to say they're probably senators and House members that would have trouble getting their way. There's an emerging consensus around this that not clear where it'll end up, but you can take a look at it if you want. And that's the end of my comments.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Oh, Lord.
Just a little bit. Now, do we know how many students have enrolled for the CNA program for next semester?
We know, right now there's approximately, and we can take up to 20 because there's a limit per class and 10.
Yeah.
So there would be maybe two, you know, a class of seven and a class of eight. But there's an overall limit, so it'd be like two sections. So it's the same thing twice.
That's awesome.
There's a lot of, as we heard from Carly, I think it was, she was so excited that, you know, Carly, are you going to be in the CNA program? No, but I have friends who are, and they're super excited. So that friends of people who are involved are as excited as that, to me, is an indication that it's really kind of hitting something that is important for students. So.
Fantastic.
Do you have another question?
That was it. Thank you.
All right.
That was easy.
Anything, any other questions? All right. We don't have public comment. I need anybody ask me to make a comment. So we're going to move to the consent agenda. Can I get a motion to approve 9.1 through 9.6 on the consent agenda?
How do you say that?
I'm sorry?
How do you say that?
So moved.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. All right. Any discussion?
Just a point of order. The consent agenda is not, there is no discussion for consent.
That's right.
So, if there's something in the consent agenda that you do want to discuss, then when the agenda is up for approval at the beginning of the meeting, what you should do is ask for that item to be pulled from the consent agenda and put under action item. And then just say, I'd like to pull new hires from the consent, and then if the motion carries, then it would be moved, and then you can discuss it.
Okay.
Because the point of the consent is that there is no discussion.
That it's not.
Right.
Okay.
Administratively. Okay.
All right. Well, then how about a roll call?
Director Blackham?
Yes.
Director Booth?
Yes.
Director Franco?
Yes.
Director Karcher?
Yes.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right. Next on the agenda is the action item. The 10.1, do I have a motion to approve the 2022 mill levy certification?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. On that, any discussion? We had a good discussion about that. So. Mm-hmm. All right, roll call, please.
Director Blackham?
Yes.
Director Booth?
Yes.
Director Fernfeller?
Yes.
Director Carter?
Yes.
Director Olson?
Yes.
All right. Next on the agenda is discussion items. We have down here CASB, convention debrief, and follow-up. Is there anything specific that anybody, any questions or feedback, thoughts, or ideas from our time together?
I thought the convention was excellent for when we all sat down and met. That was just spot on. I thought it was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that last day, I know, Craig, you weren't able to be there, but when we went and had that seminar with his postcard, I thought he was fantastic.
He
the
was.
Energy level and the things that he said was excellent.
I thought the time with the kids was very insightful.
Oh, that was great. Yeah.
The
dinner gift, that was great.
I thought the time with Melissa was terrific. Clarified so much of what our roles are and what our roles should be, and I thought it's good, and it's always going to be work in progress for all of us, but it was good. It was good.
Great way for all of us to come together.
Yep.
It was fantastic.
It was.
How many times did I say that? It's fantastic.
Well, given that you guys took all the good stuff, I'll just say that
it was fantastic.
The weather was fantastic.
It was. Oh my God.
So we didn't take all the good stuff.
That's true. And for those of you that don't really understand, Colorado Springs, specifically that location, in early December is usually bitter cold. It is like uncomfortable walking in the outside from place to place. There have been board members who slipped on the ice before. It's in the pond there by the hotel wasn't even frozen. It was not tropical, but it was
darn near for that
close.
Area.
It was beautiful.
Right, it made it very pleasant to be there.
Good. All right. So
I want to also just thank all the board members for going. It's important. I know it's a commitment of time, and I think, but it's an important in your role as elected officials, but also in your relationship as a team. There's an idea generation that happens there, both just because you're not focusing on other things, and then there's the sessions, and then there's the students or whatever, and it's an opportunity to really kind of forward both yourself as individual board members, but also the board as a team. And so it's much better, both I think individually and of course collectively when everybody's there. So.
All right.
It was fantastic.
Yes, again.
Again.
Right, terrific.
Audacious.
You don't like fantastic?
It's fantastic.
It is fantastic.
All right. Just a correction. In our next board meeting is January 10th, 2022, right? Not 2021, so just make that correction. And just everybody available to make it to that board meeting? Yes.
January 10th?
Yeah, January 10th. Cool. All right. Yeah, well, we appreciate that.
Yeah.
When? all right.
We're just soft pedaling to give Ron time to get back with his paperwork. Yeah. And he's now back. So
oh,
we can
is that where you
silly.
Went?
Yeah. So I guess I misspoke. It's the Secretary and Treasurer. Sorry, Rhonda.
Told you.
So.
Okay.
All right.
Come on,
it is now 8:17 p.m. I now adjourn the meeting.